Welcome, everyone. My name is Doug Thompson, and my co-host is Deborah Maltman. And today we're going to be continuing with our Sunday afternoon study of the original dictation of A Course in Miracles. I want to start today's program with a reminder of why we have come together to share in the study of the words that Jesus dictated to Helen and Bill. Jesus said, "Wherever two or more gather together in my name, there also shall I be." And I not only believe he said that, I believe he is here with us. We are gathered in his name. What we're doing here is both for our own learning and that of everyone, and I want to express my deep gratitude for the many contributions which have come from various people over the months. This work is more accurate, and certainly my own understanding is much better for that. This has been a magnificent experience for me, this sharing back and forth with so many people as we ponder the meaning of these words and offer each other our own insights. For those who are here for the first time, and I see some names I don't recognize, I'm going to provide a bit of a background, and those who are already familiar with this part can take a 5-minute break. As most of you know, the course exists in a number of versions as a result of extensive editing and abridgment over the years. While anyone looking at this earliest raw handwritten form will recognize that some parts certainly needed some editing, some of the editing ended up blurring and obscuring points which were originally much clearer. In many cases, this is a result of inadvertent copying mistakes that were never caught because of a lack of proofreading. And some of the most important teachings in the early part of the course simply vanished, and we don't know exactly how or why that happened. One reason for studying this material, then, is that it gives us a clearer picture not only of what Jesus originally said, but in his sidebar explanations to Helen and Bill, what he really meant. The earliest written record of A Course in Miracles is found in two collections of Helen Shipman's manuscripts, her original shorthand notes, and her later, somewhat edited transcript known as the Urtext. Hardly a week passes that someone doesn't ask me about other versions of the Course, which are also advertised or labeled as in some way original. There are actually 6 different versions of the text of the Course of which I'm aware, and 5 for which I've been able to obtain copies. Most of these have been published, and in most cases, the publisher claims each is in some way original. So we get some confusion on that topic. So what we're working with today is original in the sense of being what was originally written down by Helen Shipman before the editing process began. And it's not any one of the original scribal versions. It combines 2 of them, each of which has some unique material not shared by the other. And what I've been doing over the past few months is going through the shorthand notes and identifying material which did not make it into the Urtext, and then combining these 2 earliest versions. So the resulting document, as I said, is not any one of the 5 scribal versions, but a combination of the 2 earliest ones, which together give us or contain the earliest written record for which any evidence exists of what Helen first heard. So we call it the original dictation, and it is essentially unedited. There has been a very small amount of editing for spelling and grammar here and there, almost all of which is actually footnoted. And there may be a little more in terms of sequencing, and we're going to be discussing some of that today, but by and large, almost totally, with very few exceptions, this material is set down just the way Helen initially wrote it or typed it. Because of that, it's got some rough spots. Some segments were written down only in point form. Some sentences were never completed. In that sense, it does need editing. It's not, the way Helen initially put it down, a finished product. The notes also include some material specifically labeled as a private point and not a part of the course. This includes conversations between Helen and Jesus about topics of concern to Helen at the time. While not part of the course proper, these outtakes provide considerable insight into Helen's experience and often involve explanations of miracle principles, practical examples drawn from Helen's or Bill's own life, and as such can expand our understanding of both the course proper and the scribing experience, which resulted in what we know of today as A Course in Miracles. So what we're doing today will be a reading, some commentary and discussion of this material. Now, last week we got into the beginning of chapter 2 and stopped, unfortunately, before the end of the segment. And that segment is of a piece. And so we're going to start again at the beginning of chapter 2 and do that entire segment in this session. And I'm also going to do a review of the material we've covered in previous weeks, which is related to it. Actually, the more I look at this material, the more I think that what we're going to be reading today, which was a later insertion into the notes, it's not actually part of the notes, it comes from the Ur text, it was put in later, I think it should have been put a few pages earlier, because it basically serves as an introduction to the possession fallacies that we've been discussing in the previous two sessions. And I'm going to have more to say about that in a minute. Now, the first 8 chapters of this combined original dictation are available on the net at the following URL. And for those on the radio who can't see that, if you go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74, what will come up is a menu, and on the top left corner of that, click on Original Dictation, and it will bring you to this same document. There. Okay, now you should be able to see it on the board, the link. And we're going to be reading from that document, so anyone who wants to follow along can bring it up and do so. Alrighty. So the basic format we're using is reading and commentary plus discussion. There tends sometimes to be more commentary and discussion than reading, sometimes the other way around. While I'd encourage everyone to raise your hand if you have something to share, I'd appreciate it if you try to keep your comments focused on the topic and try to keep it under 3 minutes unless something truly exceptional arises, which it sometimes does. Deborah will be keeping an eye on the hands on the board, and she is like the chairperson here. When she acknowledges your hand and drops the mic, then you can take the mic. And towards the end of the two-hour session, I'm going to try to stop and again ask for questions and may make an attempt at summarizing the key points of the material we've covered in this session. Sometimes I do that, sometimes we just run out of time. Okay, at this point I'm going to ask Deborah to make her introductory remarks, but first I want to express what the deep gratitude that so many of us feel to David Fishman for making this facility available. However much we value it, we don't often get around to telling him how much we value this this service that he provides, and I just want to make sure that I do that today because it's so easy to forget and so easy to take it for granted. So thank you, David. And Deborah, here's the mic.
And then, oh, I should have a mic check here first. I noticed that it was getting tangled with Doug's mic as he was leaving. Yes, good. And then there's the times that you're not here, David, at the end that you get gratitude, but you're not receiving it because you aren't here even to hear it. So, yeah, thanks very much. A lot of gratitude goes out to you. Jack, I just wanted to say that there's things I just won't be able to address that right now, but it'd make a really good little excerpt on its own to put together of the valuable of the stuff that was taken out that is valuable to us as miracle workers for us to hear what Jesus says to us through Helen. So hi everyone, it's really wonderful to be here again another Sunday afternoon. Thanks, Jack. So, as Jesus requests, Let's ask, let's just say that prayer together inside ourselves to help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today. If you will tell me what to do, only that I will to do. And I always like to say, Lord, heal me, because I know I still need healing. And it's happening. So that's about all I have to say right now. So Doug, you want the mic back, because Doug is going to be going into a review now of what we have gone over and bringing us back up to chat to chapter 2, where I will start reading again. Here you go, Doug.
Okay, thank you, Deborah. Yeah, Jack, I'm going to comment on the outtakes, bloopers notion, and sometimes there's a good reason for the omission. That's absolutely true. Sometimes there is a good reason. As I mentioned, some of this material is essentially a private conversation between Helen and Jesus, which is not part of the course. And if I had to make the decision of editing the course, there's certainly pieces I would leave out. I would say that's A, not Jesus speaking, and B, not part of what he was trying to dictate here. It is at most a sidebar. So, yeah, I agree. In some cases, that material was properly edited out. At the same time, some of it is extremely interesting and potentially valuable in terms of providing contextual information about the material that was being dictated. It's a bit like sitting in the room with Helen as she's hearing it. And therefore, it can be useful, which is not an argument to say that it was improperly edited. Now, there's a lot of stuff that I think was left out inadvertently. Some is absolutely clear it was left out inadvertently, which is properly restored. And there's other stuff where a case can be made either way, that maybe it should be in, maybe it shouldn't. But what we've got here is the whole thing, so you can make up your own mind essentially what you think is appropriate and what isn't. It's all there for you to see. Judy wasn't involved in the editing, actually, since there's another comment coming up on that. The documentary evidence available and statements from Ken Watnick and Robert Gutch indicate that there were three phases of editing. One in 1968, when they basically took the shorthand notes and omitted most of the very personal material that was really clearly not part of the course, and that resulted in the urtext. The urtext also involved some dictated corrections and insertions that were dictated without notes and are not part of the shorthand notes. And Helen has described that in her autobiography accurately as following Bill's instructions that the only things that be changed would be actual typing mistakes. The dictation would not be edited, and of course the omission of the excessively personal material. 1968 was the end of the dictation of the text, and my comments here are confined to the editing of the text volume. The editing of the other volumes was done in a rather different way. It was 68 that the workbook dictation began, and the text volume was completed in 1968. In 1972, there was, between 68 and 72, there was another editing process that resulted in the Hugh Lynn Casey version. And the editing philosophy applied to that one was very different, in that some 40,000 words were omitted that are included in the urtext, including all the stuff we've been dealing with for the last month on possession, fallacies, the confusion of sexual impulses with miracle impulses, etc. All that was taken out, and just why, I don't know, because no explanation has really been offered. And to some extent, it's quite possible there was some inadvertence. Then in 1973, in May of 73, Kenneth Watnick met Helen and Bill and suggested that some further editing of the he read the HLC and suggested that some further editing was in order. And between 73 and 74, another edit was conducted, according to Ken, mostly by himself, although Helen was participating, but he reports she was quite resistant, invariably fell asleep or began to fall asleep when they were trying to edit together. And that editing process resulted in another 10,000 words being taken out and a lot of things being changed and restructured and resequenced. So it, you know, each of these three phases manifests a very different, editorial policy or philosophy of editing. So the editing wasn't all of a piece, and it didn't happen all at one time, and it wasn't done all by one person. The first phase was very minimal editing, and does reflect Bill's persistent attitude that nothing should be changed except genuine mistakes. And he was, after all, the one assigned the responsibility for editing. And Helen, in her autobiography, quite frankly, admits she wanted to change everything, but was initially restrained by Bill. Later, a lot got changed, and, well, it did. That's simply the fact. Explaining that, well, explaining it's another thing. So Judy Scotch came on the scene in May of 1975, and at that time was presented with the Nuns version, which went on to be typeset by Saul Steinberg to become the Foundation for Inner Peace first edition. So the Nuns version has a few differences from the first edition, but not very many. It's basically the same version there. So Judy wasn't involved in any of those editing processes. She hadn't even seen the course by the time the editing was substantially completed. Helen did not even understand the course in reality, so why participate in editing? And I think that was part of Bill's argument, that in order to dare to start rewording things or make them come out different, you really got to make sure you completely understand that. And I don't think he thought either of them did or were qualified to do more than, you know, clean up the spelling and grammar and ask for guidance where there were any uncertainties and questions. Jesus was adamant repeatedly that he needed to be asked and wanted to be asked and would retroactively correct any mistakes, that any scribal errors, if he was asked. Now, there's a question about Bob Scotch. I don't know, which was Judith's husband at the time, yes. Okay. So, on that point of basic editorial history, what we're going to be reading today is the beginning of Chapter 2, and most of the material we'll be covering today is included in both the HLC and the Foundation version. And it's an insert. It's labeled in the Urtext as an insert, and it was clearly written sometime after the previous material we've been covering for the last few weeks about possession fallacies. And it also looks to me, the more I look at it, that it was intended to be an introduction to that material and properly should have been placed before it rather than not quite at the end of it, sort of in the middle of it, but towards the end of it. And part of the reason why the material on possession fallacies is often confusing to people the first time they read it is because there's a serious question about whether the sequence we have in the Urtext was actually the intended sequence or if that's essentially a scribal mistake, that the pages got shuffled some way. So I have spent the day going over the sections that we're going to, that we're talking about, and I've written a little review, which hopefully will help us approach today's reading with the necessary background to understand it in context. So I'm just going to read that now. Okay, we've spent the last three sessions wading through this section, which spans the end of chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2. This material is edited out of all the later abridgments, that is, everything before the beginning of chapter 2, which we're going to be reading today. The material is somewhat complicated in that Helen has some difficulty getting it down is obvious. That is important, and even that it is important and even vital becomes apparent once it is understood. In today's reading, we should get to the end of this section. We left off last week towards the end, and the material is not likely to be very clear unless taken as a whole, so I'm going to begin today's session. I am beginning today's session with a summary of the concepts included in last week's reading, which are to some extent foundational for what we'll be reading today. What Jesus is actually doing here is explaining the psycho-spiritual dynamics of the fall, or the separation illusion, and precisely what it starts with and how misperception builds on misperception to generate the separation illusion. That's why I think it's vital, because it really explains how the separation illusion got built, and by implication, how it can be undone, what its constituent pillars are. This section uses a lot of psychological jargon, and it uses examples from Helen and Bill's own experience. There is some question about the original sequence of the material, and it's clear that after the section was dictated, Jesus asked Helen to go back and insert a substantial clarification, which might even be reasonably considered an introduction. Possession isn't really defined until the start of chapter 2. And I'm going to start this summary by looking at the definition which we'll be reading today. And I'm going to be drawing a few quotes from what we'll be reading and stitching them together to give us this definition. Both Helen and Bill had concerns about possession. And while most of us may not use the word possession to describe such concerns, I think most people I know have similar concerns to Helen. In T2A31, Jesus uses the word you, perhaps to refer to Helen or Bill specifically, or perhaps to refer to you, the reader, or all of us. And that quote is this: "You insist on thinking that people can possess you. If you believe that their thoughts or the external environment can affect you, regardless of what you think. You insist on thinking that people can possess you if you believe that their thoughts or the external environment can affect you, regardless of what they think." Now, I think the "you" there refers to most humans who do really insist on thinking that the external environment can affect us. That later will be defined as essentially the ego's thought system. The word ego won't show up for another chapter, and then there'll be an entire chapter essentially defining ego. Jesus goes on, "You are perfectly unaffected by all expressions of lack of love. These can be either from yourself and others, or from yourself to others, or from others to you." And then there's a footnote, or an aside, that Jesus addresses to Helen. "I'm glad you passed that test. It was crucial." And Helen adds, this is reference to Helen Schuchman's reluctance to take dictation as given. So what we're being told there is that she did take that dictation as given. So we can be pretty confident that that was correct. And he goes on in T2A31, "Peace is an attribute in you. You cannot find it outside. All mental illness is some form of external searching. Mental health is inner peace." And here's the kicker. "It enables you to remain unshaken by lack of love from without and capable, through your own miracles, of correcting the external conditions which proceeded from lack of love in others." So the idea of possession then really relates to the belief that anything external can affect our peace of mind, that we can in essence be possessed by people, things, spirits, or knowledge that is outside of us. And the conclusion is, peace is an attribute in you. You cannot find it outside. All mental illness is some form of external searching. Mental health is inner peace. Oh, I already read that one. Okay, sorry. My notes here have a duplication. Okay, so we see the connection with the miracle here, that the mental health is inner peace, and it's that which enables you to remain unshaken and that which makes you capable of correcting the external conditions through your own miracles. The inner peace is inside, not outside. And all these attempts to find it outside, which is what the possession fallacies are about, are obstacles to miracle-mindedness. So we see the connection with miracles. Possession fallacies then refers to all misperceptions or mistaken thoughts which result in a lack of inner peace, as a result of believing that anything external can affect us. Now, that definition actually began two paragraphs earlier. The obvious correction for all types of the possession fallacy is to redefine possession correctly, in the sense of taking over. The concept does not exist at all in divine reality, which is the only level of reality where real existence is a meaningful term. Now, we get to a really important point. No one can be taken over unless he wills to be. This is a crucial line, unless he wills to be. And that means to believe that external things can affect him or act on his will. Jesus goes on. However, if he places his mind under tyranny rather than authority, Helen inserts, see previous reference, we'll get to that in a minute. If he places his mind under tyranny rather than authority, he intrudes the submission-dominance concept onto free will himself. Now, the previous references were authority, true authority is Christ's guidance, and tyranny, twist reality in any way, and you are perceiving destructively. Reality was lost through the usurpation of reality by fantasy, which in turn produced tyranny. And this refers back to the distortion of sexual impulses and the confusion of sexual impulses and miracle impulses through sexual fantasies, and that long section on fantasies and the importance of keeping a leash on them because they block us away from reality, which results in tyranny, where our will seems to be taken over by our fantasies, and therefore is no longer free, and it becomes tyrannous. All in that process, we're ignoring Christ's control or Christ's guidance, which is the true authority, and we're ignoring reality. It is our own fantasies that have intruded the submission-dominance concept or the idea of possession onto free will. And what actually gets possessed is our will. We think someone else has taken it over, or some external circumstances. So there's a multi-part cause-effect relationship being outlined here that builds error upon error into severe perceptual distortions. The root is the confusion of the miracle impulse with the sexual impulse and the sexual and related fantasies that usurp reality. So we stop seeing what's real and we start seeing what we imagine to be real. These basically misperceive the body as the person, or perhaps more aptly, misperceive the person as a body. Bodies, obviously enough, can be dominated or imprisoned, but persons or souls cannot be dominated or imprisoned except by their own will. You can put a man's body in prison, but you can't put a man's soul in prison. The first mistake man made then, and if this was in a later chapter, we'd likely find the word ego there used instead of man, was to mistake himself and his brother for their bodies. The second mistake was to usurp the reality of souls, persons, for body-related fantasies. Having mistaken ourselves and our brothers for our bodies, We then will to impose our fantasies on reality and believe that the body-based fantasies of others can be imposed on us. This is the replacement of authority, which is Christ's guidance, with tyranny, which is caused by replacing reality with body-centered fantasies. We may not have been conscious of exercising our will and choosing this approach, but Jesus is telling us here that we did choose it, and by choosing it, impaired or imprisoned our will. By implication, if it was an act of will to get here, an act of will can get us out. We can choose again. Now, T2A30. Jesus goes on in that quote, "This produces the obvious contradiction inherent in any formulation that associates free will with imprisonment. Even in very mild forms, this kind of association is risky and may spread quite unexpectedly, particularly under external stress. That is because it can be internally controlled only if external conditions are peaceful. This is not safe because external conditions are produced by the thoughts of many, not all of whom are pure in heart as yet." So this leads back to where we began with the example of the choice to believe that external conditions can affect us at all. If we believe that, and generally we do, our will is not really free because we have chosen to give our will to external conditions. For example, how often have we thought or said, "There was no alternative given the external conditions. I had to do whatever I did." If we believe that, and quite often we do, then we believe our will is subordinate to those external conditions. And so we are really possessed by them and no longer exercising free will or free choice. In short, we are no longer listening to guidance or the authority of guidance, but to the tyranny of fantasies. Now, in the preceding pages comes material which logically follows from that set of definitions. And that is a detailed discussion of four kinds of possession fallacies, all of which stem from the fear of the irresistible attraction of God. That's key, that all these ideas we're talking about here, these possession fallacies, stem from the fact that God exercises an irresistible attraction, and to a part of ourselves or to the ego, that is very frightening. In each case, man attempts to substitute something else for God. Now, the four elements that we've been reading about in the previous weeks are possession fallacies associated with things, people, spirits, and knowledge. Each of these possession fallacies is a misuse of knowledge, in which a person substitutes possession of or by things, people, spirits, or knowledge for the irresistible attraction of God. Each of these becomes a substitute for God, in essence, an object of worship or an idol. For each of these, there is also a denial mechanism, and denial is used in a specific way here. In the extreme form, the possession fallacy associated with things leads to theft or kleptomania, the pack rat or compulsive collector. The denial mechanism for possession fallacies associated with things is an aversion to things, or bankruptcy. The denial mechanism here is the reversal of the fallacy. It's still false, but it manifests in an opposite direction. Instead of trying to collect your own people, you end up with a hermit or a recluse who wants no contact with people. In the case of spiritual possession fallacies, you have witchcraft, or the attempt to control spirits. Its denial mechanism would be atheism, or the denial of the spiritual realm entirely. In the case of knowledge, Jesus mentions, and I'm quoting, "You claim you can't read, and Bill claims he can't speak." That was addressed to Helen. So the denial of the knowledge that's actually there. Now we have the latter insertion already discussed, where our reading begins today, which is not found in the notes, but only in the air text. Arguably, this should actually come at the beginning. This is where chapter 2 begins, and both the HLC and the Foundation version include this material, or at least most of it, with some interesting changes in terminology in the Foundation version. And at that point, we can begin today's reading. Here you go, Deborah.
Chapter 2, The Illusion of Separation, T2A Introduction, in parentheses, insert for page 61. T2A1, this section is inserted here because it deals with a more fundamental misuse of knowledge referred to in the Bible as the cause of the fall, in parentheses, or separation. There are several introductory remarks which are intended to make these explanations less fear-provoking. The first is a couplet which I drew to your attention during the fragments of Midsummer Night's Dream, which you heard last night. Be as thou wast wont to be, see as thou wast wont to see. It is noteworthy that these words were said by Oberon in releasing Titania from her own errors, both of being and perceiving. These were the words which re-established her true identity as well as her true abilities and judgment. The similarity here is obvious. There are also some definitions which I asked you to take from the dictionary, which will also be helpful. Their somewhat unusual nature is due to the fact that they are not the first definitions in their chronological appearance. Nevertheless, the fact that each of them does appear in the dictionary should be reassuring. Project, verb, to extend forward or out. Project, noun, a plan in the mind. World, a natural grand division. In parentheses, note that you originally wrote word instead of world. We will refer later to projection as related to both mental illness and mental health. It will also be commented on that Lucifer literally projected himself from heaven. We also have observed that man can create an empty shell, but cannot create nothing at all. This emptiness provides the screen for the misuse of projection. T2A4. The Garden of Eden, which is described as a literal garden in the Bible, was not originally an actual garden at all. It was merely a mental state of complete need lack. Even in the literal account, it is noteworthy that the pre-separation state was essentially one in which man needed nothing. The Tree of Knowledge, again, an overly literal concept. In parentheses, as is clearly shown by the subsequent reference to eating of the fruit of the tree, is a symbolic reference to some of the misuses of knowledge referred to in the section immediately preceding this one. There is, however, considerable clarification of this concept, which must be understood before the real meaning of the detour into fear can be fully comprehended. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, on the projection, the word project, there's an important point that I want to make here. I've actually got it written down because I'm prepared for it. The word projection, as we've just read it and just heard it, was one of the things that was edited in the Foundation version is that projection, wherever it was used to refer to the divine sort of projection, is changed to extension. And thus we're left with the impression that all projection means ego hurling. Now initially, projection refers to anything that extends outward, and that's why the definition was given, to extend forward or out. And the two kinds, both divine and ego, are used. So the world was created by God projecting himself. And in the editing, all of the divine references to projection were changed to extension, which seems like it could actually help us clarify things. But there's a number of uses of the word projection where it involves both kinds. And those weren't changed. And so some of those quotes end up looking like they mean only the ego when in fact they mean both. And in chapter 21, there's there's one that really draws our attention to the importance of this because it actually explains what's going on. And that is the famous projection makes perception line, which, if you think of projection as only ego, that means everything I perceive is created by my ego, so it's got to be, it's got to suck, in essence. And when the statement is used in chapter 12, projection makes perception, that's exactly how it looks. But in 21, there's some material added. So I'm going to read the paragraph from chapter 21 because it really clarifies the concept of projection here. Projection makes perception. The world you see is what you gave it, nothing more than that. But though it is no more than that, it is not less. Therefore, to you, it is important. It is the witness to your state of mind, the outside picture of an inward condition. As a man thinketh, so does he perceive. Therefore, seek not to change the world, but will to change your mind about the world. Perception is a result and not a cause. And that is why order of miracles is meaningless. Now, here's the kicker. Everything looked upon with vision is healed and holy. Nothing perceived without it means anything. And where there is no meaning, there is chaos. So in other words, as we perceive, if we look upon everything looked upon with vision, or everything looked upon with God's love, with the spiritual eye, which is our organ for vision, is healed and holy. When we look with love, what we see is loving. When we look with fear, what we see is fearful. When we look with anger, what we see is angry. As we project, so we perceive. And we can project love just as equally as we can project hatred, anger, fear, anything else. And there's a number of other instances where the word projection is used in the Course in the inclusive sense, that it involves both kinds and not just the ego kind. So it's important to remember that projection makes perception doesn't mean ego makes perception. It means that our choice of what to project is the cause of our experience of what we perceive. Now, I just happened to notice a question there from Jack. Order of difficulties and miracles is impossible, not order of miracles. Yes, order of difficulties in miracles, or order period in terms of one being more significant or more difficult or more important than another. There's no order. They're all the same. Yeah, that would be right. Right-minded perception would be extension. Yes, it would be. Right-minded perception would be extension. Right-minded projection would be extension. The extension or projection is what causes the perception. Okay. So, Deborah, I'm going to toss you back the mic there. That's what I wanted to say about that particular word, projection. And in that, also in the Foundation version, that line that you read about projection, I'm not sure projection is defined above, is actually changed to extension. And I think that that is an editing mistake, because the projection is intended to include both what the ego does as a counterfeit of the divine kind and the divine kind. The ego simply distorts as opposed to completely invents. And projection is as much done by God as by the ego. Okay, dropping the mic.
Okay, I was wondering what shun means, T-I-O-N, so I looked it up and I posted it, and it says that it wouldn't send it because it contained too many characters or excess spaces. Okay, so shun means the act of, and it would be projecting, or the state of being projected, or the thing that is projected. T-I-O-N, Doug, projection. So that that clarified my curiosity. So I just was sharing there what I was into a bit when you were talking. So T2A4, the origins of separation. We're on T2A4. Christian, I take it you found where we are at. Because you did say thanks there, so yeah, I'm sure you did. Yep, thanks. Okay, projection as defined above, parentheses, this refers to the verb, close parentheses, is a fundamental attribute of God, which he also gave to his son. In the creation, God projected his creative ability out of himself toward the souls which he created, and also imbued them with the same loving wish, in parentheses, or will, to create. We have commented before on the fundamental error involved in confusing what has been created with what is being created. We have also emphasized that man, insofar as the term relates to soul, has not only been fully created, but also been created perfect. There is no emptiness in him. The next point, too, has already been made, but bears repetition here. The soul, because of its own likeness to its creator, is creative. No child of God is capable of losing this ability because it is inherent in what he is. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, that distinction, the fundamental error in confusing what has been created with what is being created, and what has been created is, well, I'm going to read the previous quote where that distinction is drawn. The creation of the soul itself has already been perfectly accomplished, but the creation by souls has not. So we're talking about what God has created, what has been created and is eternal, and can't be uncreated, with what is being created by us, essentially, as souls. Okay. And, oh, also, Jack had mentioned projection in psychology always means disowning something. Yeah, projection defined as defined above here is as Deborah just read, it's I think Jesus is providing this definition because he's not using it in that strict psychological jargon sense. And he describes it as a fundamental attribute of God, which he also gave to his son, to us. So we have the capacity to project or extend, which is the definition of projection. And what we project or extend outward will be what's in our minds, what our thoughts are. And that can be love or that can be fear. And the projection, which we'll read later, makes the perception. We end up perceiving through the filter of our projection, in essence. So God, in the creation, God projected his creative ability out of himself towards the souls which he created, and imbued them with the same loving wish or will to create. Okay. Now, if there's any other questions that you've seen, Deborah, that I didn't, that I should be addressing, draw my attention to them, because I haven't seen a lot on the board here today. Dropping mic.
Okay, Doug, there is another question here from Jack. It would seem to me that this definition would confuse the course student as to definition of extension versus projection. Where do you draw the distinction? Here you go.
There isn't a distinction. They're the same thing. And there's two kinds, the kind the ego does and the kind God does. And so extension normally refers to the divine kind. Whether we're doing it or God's doing it, it's the divine creative ability to extend love. And projection usually refers to what the ego is doing in terms of hurling guilt. But there are those cases where projection refers to both kinds, both what the ego can do, which is essentially a distortion of the God-given ability to extend. That's how I understand it. And it can be potentially confusing, I agree, which is one reason why I'm drawing so much attention to the effort Jesus made right here at the beginning to define the term and clearly explain what he meant by it so that we wouldn't trip over it later. And this is one of the several things where Jesus says at the end of this chapter, or is it the end of chapter 3, I forget, that the student really needs to understand this initial material for the rest of it to make any sense. So he says, go back and study the notes up to that point, and I think it's the end of chapter 3, actually, really carefully, because the fundamental concepts within which the fundamental foundational concepts are being laid out here, without which understanding the rest will be much more difficult. Okay, dropping the mic.
Jack, do you have a mic there? Would you like to take the mic to explain more whatever you're saying here? Jack has on the board a follow-up to what you had said, Doug, disagreeing and saying potentially is not the word for it. It is totally confusing and would not come from God. Jesus is not into anything but simplicity. Jesus gave us a course. It's damn hard. Anyways, I don't see your hand up. And Doug, you don't have... Okay, Doug, here's your hand. Here's the mic, I mean.
Well, Jesus gave us anything but simplicity. I don't know. I mean, that is one way to interpret this, that because it is not really simple such that any grade 2 student could understand it perfectly, therefore it can't be from Jesus. That is an argument. I don't happen to buy it, but I think what we're seeing here is that Jesus is first addressing Helen in terms she can understand and using terminology that's meaningful to her. And a lot of the time, because she is a research professor, a research psychologist and professor of psychology, there are concepts that are totally familiar to her because she's conducting research on them or teaching courses on them that are not familiar to most of us if we haven't studied psychology recently or even at the time Helen studied it. That doesn't mean to me that it's not Jesus, that the ideas there are not Jesus' ideas, in the words appropriate to the context within which they were spoken. Okay. Dropping mic.
Okay, Jack, here you go. I'll pass the mic to you.
Yeah. Say, Doug, this is your class, you know, so I certainly am not here to create conflict, but I think it's wonderful to have ambiguity and to be able to appreciate each other for different ideas, thoughts, of what we believe the Course is saying. Now, I would never agree that Jesus, in any of his dictation to Helen, ever would have used the word projection to mean the same as extension. And never would they be anything other than the opposite. You know, projection is the... the psychological definition, of course, of projection is that which we disown within ourselves. But to create confusion and conflict around the word projection and have it to be used to sometimes mean extension is certainly to confuse anybody who's a Course student trying to learn this work. Jesus, in his simplicity, never meant for us to be confused and to see the simplicity of this work. So, this urtext work that you talk about here, I think for a Course scholar is interesting. You know, certainly it's interesting to try to study the history of what happened back in 1968. It's not anything that I'm really concerned with myself, but I do enjoy coming in here to listen to what you guys are talking about and to see if it makes sense to me. But yeah, I totally disagree with any idea of projection meaning the same thing as extension in the way that Jesus defined it in his dictation of A Course in Miracles. It seems to make no sense that he would want to cross over into that definition for projection. Other than right-minded thinking, right-minded perception would be extension, as I said in my script. You know, right-minded thinking would be extension as a form of perception. Okay, here's the mic back.
Well, thanks for that, Jack. And I think that's a really interesting perception you bring to bear on it. I would point out two things. That projection means extension is a dictionary definition. They're synonyms in the dictionary. So I don't agree that they're inherently confusing, that to match the terms and use them synonymously is in any way, shape, or form inappropriate English or less than clear. It's necessary to offer the definition to a psychologist who will be thinking that projection always means disown, and to clarify that that's not what he means by the word. And as pointed out, as late as chapter 21, we have the word projection makes perception in the context where it's clearly explained that what we project, and we can project anything, determines what we perceive, and that it doesn't really refer only to the ego kind of projection. And secondly, I think the reason it becomes confusing is that you have read the edited version where projection is usually, meaning divine projection, is usually changed to extension. So you've got the idea from the editors that extension means one thing and projection means something different, and when suddenly they're meaning the same, that could be confusing. But had that editing change not been made, the confusion would not have arisen. Dropping the mic. Deborah.
Okay, Christian, you have something to say on this topic. I'll hand you the mic.
Yes, well, I asked Jesus, as it were. I asked Jesus what was the answer. And what I heard was the confusion is in the mind of the reader. That's all I heard. Thank you. It couldn't really be anywhere else, could it? But I think he means, well, I'm checking. I think he means there's some consistency. I'm checking. Yeah, confusion can be nowhere else, obviously. Confusion is an ego thought in itself. Yeah, I can grow fat on that. I can puff up something, you know, drop an oil spill on A Course of Miracles, blacken the whole goddamn thing. But I'm hearing somewhere that it's perfect. See, Melissa just wrote perfect on the board, and Jack Roddy wrote perfect. So you see there's an agreement in capital me. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Christian. If anybody else has anything to say, I don't see any hands up. And Jackson, I just wanted to say that you seemed a bit troubled or concerned that we are actually going through earlier information and you see it as not worthy of us doing, or this not something that is necessary to be gone through. But I would just request that you see that it is for some of us, and maybe not for you. So maybe I'm misinterpreting you. Maybe I'm picking up something incorrectly here. I was just going by what I was reading on the board. But anyways, it is for me, or I wouldn't be. Okay, Jack, I must have misinterpreted. Okay, so I'm going to continue reading T2A5. I believe that's where I'm starting. Yeah, it is. All right. Whenever projection is true, I'm a little bit mixed up here. Whenever projection in its inappropriate sense is utilized, it always implies that some emptiness, in parentheses, or lack of everything, must exist, and that it is within man's ability to put his own ideas there instead of the truth. If you will consider carefully what this entails, the following will become quite apparent. First, the assumption is implicit that what God has created can be changed by the mind of man. Second, the concept that what is perfect can be rendered imperfect, in parentheses, or wanting, is intruded. Third, the belief that man can distort the creations of God, in parentheses, including himself, has arisen and is tolerated. Fourth, that since man can create himself, the direction of his own creation is up to him. These related distortions represent a picture of what actually occurred in the separation. None of this existed before, nor does it actually exist now. The world, as defined above, was made as a natural grand division or projecting outward of God. That is why everything which he created is like him. It should be noted that the opposite of pro is con. Strictly speaking, then, the opposite of projecting is conjecting, a term which referred to a state of uncertainty or guesswork. Other errors arise in connection with ancillary defenses to be considered later. For example, dejection, which is obviously associated with depression, injection, which can be misinterpreted readily enough in terms of possession fallacies, in parentheses, particularly penetration, and rejection, which is clearly associated with denial. It should be noted that the rejection can be used as refusing, a term which necessarily involves a perception of what is refused as something unworthy. Just want to check that you're still with us, Doug. Usually you're jumping in by now. Where's your name? Yep, okay. T2A8. Projection as undertaken by God was very similar to the kind of inner radiance which the children of the Father inherit from him. It is important to note that the term project for outward necessarily implies that the real source of projection is internal. This is as true of the Son as of the Father. The world, in its original connotation, included both the proper creation of man by God and the proper creation by man in his right mind. The latter required the endowment of man by God with free will, because all loving creation is freely given. Nothing in either of these statements implies any sort of level of involvement or, in fact, anything except one continuous line of creation in which all aspects are of the same order. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, well, in that segment from T2A5, well, it actually begins a little earlier, through to the end of T2A9, basically is expanding on Jesus' request to Helen to look up two words in the dictionary, project and world. And he's explaining how he's using these words, what he means by them, and that he's not using the primary dictionary definitions of either. And if that's true, if this really happened, if he's really saying, this is what I mean by it, this is really important information in terms of our understanding of those words when they are used subsequently, because he's laying out for us here, this is what I mean by that word. And world, you'll see he is not saying he's using the most common definition, but rather a secondary one, which is natural grand division, or essentially a psychological or mental or perceptual category rather than a physical planet. So the world as you see it is contrasted, you know, the world as ego sees it essentially, is later contrasted with the world as the Holy Spirit sees it, which is called the real world. So there's a false world and a real world, and these two are contrasted repeatedly throughout the course. And neither, normally, refers to planet Earth. When he wants to talk about Earth, he uses the word Earth 150 times, or 139 times. But the contrast between the world as ego sees it and the forgiven world or the healed world or the real world as Holy Spirit sees it is not a contrast between different planets or different places or different physical objects, but different ideas about the world which come from different projections or extensions that the mind makes on the world. So what do I project onto it? Do I project love or do I project fear? Am I seeing with the Holy Spirit's vision or am I seeing with the ego's distortion? Depending on which choice I make, what I see of one and the same physical object or physical planet will be entirely different. That's what's being laid out here. And I think it's really crucial. To my mind, it is totally crucial to have those concepts in mind in order to understand what Jesus is saying later about worlds and about projection. Because if we define the words differently than he does, we're going to come up with meanings different than the meanings he intended. So that brings us to the lives of the serpent. Now note also that this entire segment that we've been dealing with for 3 or 4 weeks now is an explanation of what separation illusion means and the psychodynamics and the spiritual dynamics that went in to creating the illusion, essentially what it's made of. This is the architecture of the separation illusion, how we made the impression of a world that's not really there, and how we defend it and reinforce it with various psychological mechanisms to convince ourselves that what is true is not true, or that what is not true is true, which is the definition of illusion, to mistake the truth for falsehood or falsehood for truth. And he's also using the creation myth in the Garden of Eden as kind of a template to interpret these ideas or structure his discussion of these ideas. So we come back now from Adam and Eve and the fruit of the tree, which we read about last week, to the lies of the serpent. And Deborah, here you go.
Okay, so T2A10. When the lies of the serpent were introduced, they were specifically called lies because they are not true. When man listened, all he heard was untruth. He does not have to continue to believe what is not true unless he chooses to do so. All of his miscreations can disappear in the well-known twinkling of an eye because it is a visual misperception. Man's spiritual... Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, so here is an explanation of the metaphor of the serpent. And this is referring, I believe, to all of the lengthy previous discussions about distortions of miracle principles, that they're all misperceptions or distortions of the truth. In other words, they're not true, or they're the lies of the serpent. So the lies of the serpent, he's saying, is a metaphorical symbol for all these psycho-spiritual tricks that we've played on ourselves to mistake our brothers for his body and to believe that forces outside of ourselves can really have an effect on us, and to believe that our perceptions are somehow something other than the product of our projections or extensions. So that's, I think, a really crucial link to recognize. Anyways, onto the spiritual eye, or the capacity of a human to perceive at the spiritual rather than the physical level. Deborah.
T2A11. Man's spiritual eye can sleep, but as will shortly appear in the notes, parentheses, reference Bob, elevator operator, close parenthesis, a sleeping eye can still see. One translation of the fall, a view emphasized by Mary Baker Eddy, and worthy of note, is that a deep sleep fell upon Adam, while the Bible continues to associate this sleep as a kind of anesthetic utilized for protection of Adam during the creation of Eve. Mrs. Eddy was correct in emphasizing that nowhere is there any reference made to his wake-up. While Christian Science is clearly incomplete, this point is much in its favor. The history of man in the world as he saw it has not been characterized by any genuine or comprehensive reawakening or rebirth. This is impossible as long as man projects in the spirit of miscreation. It still remains within him to project as God projected his own spirit to him. In reality, this is his only choice, because his free will was made for his own joy in creating the perfect. Doug.
Okay, this is another situation where the early chapters are a bit like a table of contents to what will come later. A couple of very key ideas are being introduced, and anyone who's read any version of the Course will know that they're going to be discussed in much greater length later. First off, we have the concept of the history of man in the world as he saw it has not been characterized by any genuine or comprehensive reawakening or rebirth, partly because the world as man sees it, which if this were in chapter 4, it would be ego, is basically designed to prevent that from happening. As long as man projects in the spirit of miscreation, it is impossible for any genuine or comprehensive reawakening or rebirth. But it remains within him to project or extend as God projected his own spirit onto him. And in reality, this is the only choice, because his free will was made for his own joy in creating the perfect. So we will, when we understand the situation completely, and when we recognize our choice is free and our will is free, always choose that which is most joyful to us. We would only choose otherwise if we didn't understand the situation and we thought somehow that choosing against our joy would somehow make us better off. And that relates to the distortions of miracle principles and the lies of the serpent, that we end up believing those things, which creates the world as we see it through the lies of the serpent. Deborah.
So we've caught up to now, we're starting where we had left off last week, so this has not been into last week. T2A13. All fear is ultimately reducible to the basic misperception of man's ability to usurp the power of God. It is again emphasized that he neither can nor has been able to do this. In this statement lies the real justification for his escape from fear. This is brought about by his acceptance of the atonement, which places him in a position to realize that his own errors never really occurred. Doug.
Okay, again, that theme of usurpation. And the usurpation, that word shows up several times previously, always in the concept, in the context of fantasies, things we made up, replacing reality. We choose to reject reality or usurp reality with fantasies. And the fantasy here is that man can run the universe instead of God, usurp the power of God with our fantasies of our own importance. And it's important to emphasize that we neither can nor have ever been able to do this. And this is the justification for the escape from fear. This is brought about by his acceptance of the atonement, which has previously been defined as undoing that misperception, which places him in a position to realize that his own errors never really occurred, and therefore have no consequences in eternity. Deborah.
T2A14. When the deep sleep fell upon Adam, he was then in a condition to experience nightmares, precisely because he was sleeping. If a light is suddenly turned on while someone is dreaming, and the content of his dream is fearful, he is initially likely to interpret the light itself as part of the content of his own dream. However, as soon as he awakens, the light is correctly perceived as the release from the dream, which is no longer accorded reality. I would like to conclude this with the biblical injunction, "Go ye and do likewise." It is quite apparent that this depends on the kind of knowledge which was not referred to by the tree of knowledge, which bore lies as fruit. The knowledge that illuminates rather than obscures is the knowledge which not only makes you free, but also shows you clearly that you are free. Doug.
Okay. Go ye and do likewise, which meshes in nicely with the listen, learn, and do segments. This is the end of the later interpolation or insert, which I discussed earlier, that I suspect, having read it now 50 times, really was intended as an introduction to the whole segment on possession fallacies in general. And where it ended up being inserted was sort of towards the end of that. And so we're now going back and picking up where the notes continues without interruption from the very last paragraph of chapter 1, which was what we read last week before this week's segment began. That has to do with the four possession fallacies associated with people, things, spirits, or knowledge. The paragraph is T2A15. And I suppose I should remind anyone on the radio that you can get access to this document that we're reading if you want to follow along with us at www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74 and click on original dictation. And for those who can see the board, I'll just paste it again. Here we go. Oh, Deborah already did. I don't know what the control there is for, but if you do a control F in your browser, you'll get a search window and type in T2A15, and that will take you right to the paragraph where Deborah will be picking up reading now. Deborah, here you go.
The preceding sections were inserted because of the necessity of distinguishing between real and false knowledge. Having made this distinction, it is well to return to the errors already listed a while back. It might be well to recapitulate them here. 1. The first involved the fallacy that only the physical is real. 2. The second involved things rather than people. 3. The third involves the endowment of the physical with non-physical properties, and the fourth clarified the misuse of knowledge. All of them were subsumed under possession fallacies, the denial mechanism for 3, the fear of or desire for spirit possession, has already been set forth in some detail and will also continue after the following. the corresponding denial mechanism for one, the fallacy that only the physical is real, is the sense of physical inability or impotence. The denial mechanism for two, the attempt to associate things with human attributes, is often bankruptcy. Collectors of things often drive themselves well beyond their financial means in an attempt to force discontinuance. If this idea of cessation cannot be tolerated, a strange compromise involving both insatiable possessiveness and insatiable throwing away, parentheses, bankruptcy, may result. An example is the inveterate or compulsive gambler, particularly the horse racing addict. Here the conflicted drive is displaced both from people and things and is invested in animals. The implied derogation of people in the cause is the cause of the underlying extreme superstition of the horse racing addict. The alcoholic is in a similar position, except that his hostility is more inward than outward directed. Defenses aimed at protecting, in parentheses, or retaining, error are particularly hard to undo because they introduce second-order misperceptions which obscure the underlying errors still further. Doug.
Okay, that line has stood out for me dozens of times in the last few weeks when we've been going over this segment of the material. Defenses aimed at protecting or holding on to errors are particularly hard to undo because they introduce second-order misperceptions which obscure the underlying errors still further. And I mean, this discussion, at one point, the term ego defenses is used, which would have been a term familiar to Helen and Bill. The ways our ego defends its illusions, say that the body, I am a body, that's one ego illusion. All defenses aimed at protecting that, are that kind of thing, are particularly hard to undo because they introduce second-order misperceptions which obscure the underlying error that they're actually, we're really spirit. The underlying error is mistaking the body for the spirit. But in defending the body, all kinds of other things end up getting laid over the underlying error, which makes it, which tends to make it hidden and difficult for a person to recognize. When looking at ego defenses of any kind, and if we're honest with ourselves, we can recognize what's an ego defense. We need, because they're particularly hard to undo or for us to accept the atonement with respect to them, it's particularly important that we make a little bit of extra effort to allow them to be undone for us. And that's what I wanted to say about that one, Deborah.
Okay, the pseudo-corrective mechanism, actually I'm just going to say here T2A19 is the paragraph that I'm starting at. The pseudo-corrective mechanism of three, possession associated with spirits, is apt to be more varied because of the more inclusive nature of the error, which has already been mentioned. Some of the possibilities are listed below. A. One aspect of the perceived possession-possessed conflict can be raised to predominance. If this is attempted in connection with possessing, it leads to the paranoid solution. The underlying component of being possessed is retained in the persecution fantasies, which are generally concomitants. I think I got it. B. If being possessed, is brought to ascendance, a state of some sort of possession by external forces results, but not with a major emphasis on attacking others. Attack by others becomes the more obvious component. In the more virulent forms, there is a sense of being possessed by demons, and unless there is vacillation with A, possession versus being possessed, a catatonic solution is more likely than a paranoid one. The focused paranoid has become more rigid in his solution and centers on one source of projection to escape from vacillation. Parentheses aside, it should be noted that this type of paranoia is an upside-down form of religion because of its obvious attempt to unify into oneness. Close parenthesis. Both 1, 2, and 4, body, things, and knowledge, are more likely to produce neurotic rather than psychotic states, though this is by no means guaranteed. However, 3, distortions relating to spirit possession, is inherently more vulnerable to the psychotic correction, again because of the more fundamental level confusion which is involved. It should be noted, however, that the greater fear which is induced by 3, distortions relating to spirit possession, can itself reach psychotic proportions, thus forcing the individual closer and closer to a psychotic solution. It is emphasized here that these differences have no effect at all on the miracle, which can heal any of them with equal ease. This is because of the miracle's inherent avoidance of within-error distinctions. Its sole concern is to distinguish between truth on the one hand and all kinds of error on the other. This is why some miracles seem to be of greater magnitude than others. But remember the first point in this course, i.e., that there is no order of difficulty in miracles. The emphasis on mental illness, which is marked in these notes, reflects the undoing aspect of the miracle. The doing aspect is, of course, much more important, but a true miracle cannot occur on a false basis. Sometimes the undoing must precede it. You still with us, Doug? Notice how uneasy I get when you're not raising your hand. Okay. At other times, both can occur simultaneously, but you are not up to this at the moment. Further insights into mental illness can be misused and lead to preoccupation with one's own symptoms. This is why this area is less constructive for most people than a course primarily devoted to mental health. However, some professions will find some principles of mental illness constructive, especially those which are concerned with mental illness in others. This obviously includes psychologists. Here you go, Doug.
Okay. Part of the reason I'm not saying anything is it's 5:43, and I want to make sure we get through this section, which is all of a piece. And needs to be dealt with together, that we get through all of it today. And then I will have some, I think we can do it, because we've only got 1, 2, 3, 4 more paragraphs, and then I'm going to make some comments. And there may be questions and comments from others at that point also. So I think most of this is fairly clearly stated here, but if there's questions, we'll have keep them in your mind. We'll have a chance to get to them in a few minutes. Deborah.
The possession fallacy, T2A29. The obvious correction for all types of possession fallacy is to redefine possession correctly. In the sense of taking over, the concept does not exist at all in divine reality, which is the only level of reality where real existence is a meaningful term. No one can be taken over unless he wills to be. However, if he places his mind under tyranny rather than authority, see previous reference. Just a second here. Seems to be a misplaced parentheses there. Okay, see previous reference. He intrudes the submission dominance concept onto free will himself. This produces the obvious contradiction inherent in any formulation that associates free will with imprisonment. Even in very mild forms, this kind of association is risky and may spread quite unexpectedly, particularly under external stress. This is because it can be internally controlled only if external conditions are peaceful. This is not safe because external conditions are produced by the thoughts of many, not all of whom are pure in heart as yet. Why should you be at their mercy? This issue is very close. Oh, Doug, you have your hand up there. Sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, see previous reference there. No one can be taken over unless he wills to be. However, if he places his mind under tyranny rather than authority, see previous reference. Tyranny, I typed it out there. It's the usurpation of reality by fantasy. Authority is Christ's guidance or reality. So, T2A31, this follows from, this is not safe because external conditions are produced by the thoughts of many, not all of whom are pure in heart as yet. And Deborah, continue.
Why should you be at their mercy? This issue is very closely related to the whole possession issue. You insist on thinking that people can possess you if you believe that their thoughts, in parentheses, or the external environment, can affect you regardless of what they think. You are perfectly unaffected by all expressions of lack of love. These can be either from yourself and others, or from yourself to others, or from others to you. I'm glad you passed that test. It was crucial. This is reference to Helen Schuckman's reluctance to take dictations as given. Those last three lines were in parentheses. T2A32, peace is an attribute in you. You cannot find it outside. All mental illness is some form of external searching. Mental health is inner peace. It enables you to remain unshaken by lack of love from without and capable, through your own miracles, of correcting the external conditions which proceed from lack of love in others. I'll just read that last paragraph again, Doug. Peace is an attribute in you. You cannot find it outside. All mental illness is some form of external searching. Mental health is inner peace. It enables you to remain unshaken by lack of love from without and capable, through your own miracles, of correcting the external conditions which proceed from lack of love in others. Doug.
Well, that brings us to the end of that section, and I think we'd better not even try to venture into the next one, which is going to take way more than the 12 minutes available. We see in this last paragraph something that is a great summary statement. It could almost be an introductory statement, because this entire segment on possession fallacies is about the idea that people, places, people or bodies, things, spirits, in a debased sense, or knowledge, in a sense, can be used to replace the irresistible attraction of God and somehow or other save us. And all of these are distortions of miracle impulses, like the distortion of sexual confusion of sexual impulses with miracle impulses that we dealt with a few weeks ago. And the importance of this in terms of understanding miracles is that with those distortions in mind, if we're subject to them, our capacity to be miracle workers is severely impaired. And the remedy is to recognize that nothing external can do the trick. Peace is an attribute in you, and peace is a precondition for the miracle worker. And with inner peace, when we recognize that nothing external can really affect us unless we will it to, then we are in a position to be miracle workers, which can correct the external conditions which proceed from lack of love. So this is a crucial kind of understanding, if we want to understand what Jesus means by miracles, and what he means by miracle worker, and what he means by purification. And it involves a detailed description of how the separation illusion occurred, what makes it up, and ultimately here in this paragraph, how it can be undone. That all of these confusions or distortions that associate something external with salvation, they're distortions, they're bogus, they're illusions. They're not true. And the truth is that we are as God created us, as the workbook will come to remind us later. And I think it's a very profound little bit of literature that Jesus has laid out here in these segments. Now, I'm going to ask if there's any questions. Because we've got 9 minutes and a chance for questions and comments, if anybody has any. Good Lord, no. Well, usually by this time of the evening, we've got questions and comments popping up. Any examples of second order misperceptions? I had a couple in mind earlier. I should have written them down because let's go back to that paragraph. Where is it? Defense is aimed at protecting or retaining error. It's T2A18. Are particularly hard to undo because they introduce second order misperceptions which obscure the underlying errors still further. Okay, a second order misperception. A first order misperception would be something like, I am a body, defends my ego. Or it might be something like, I am right, I need to be right. misuse of knowledge in the category 4 of possession distortions, that my ego depends on my interpretation being correct. And if that defense can end up getting layered in with second order misperceptions, because a second order misperception would be, say you disagree with me and I'm defending my need to be right against what I perceive as your comment suggesting I'm wrong. A second order misperception might be that, you're a schmuck anyways, or you committed adultery, or there's something else unworthy about you, which really has nothing to do with the first order defense of right versus wrong. It's a second order misperception. But it reinforces the first one by distracting attention from it. So instead of talking about who's right and who's wrong and why this is an issue for anybody, we end up talking about who committed adultery with whom, or any number of other extraneous diversions that can get layered on, so that in a conflict model, for instance, between two people, what often happens is that an initial misperception ends up having like a layer cake, like more and more misperceptions are laid on it, so that after a while, nobody can remember what we were fighting about. Because currently we're engaged in fighting about the last exchange, which is 6 weeks removed from what actually triggered the whole thing in the first place. We've just been laying on layers and layers and layers of distraction, which make it very, very difficult to find out what, in fact, is the underlying error that triggered the whole thing. Now, on the board, I'm reading. Carmen writes, first order misperception would be anything that follows directly from the error that we can change what God created. First order misperception would be anything that follows directly from the error, from the misperception or error that we can change what God created. That would be an example of a first order defense, perhaps. What I'm reading here is defenses, ego defenses, aimed at protecting or retaining ego errors. Now, every illusion the ego has, it defends. And usually when that defense is called forth because of some event that challenges it, second-order misperceptions quickly jump onto it so that we're not even beginning to look at the first order. They're hidden because we now seem to be, as in the example given, dealing with somebody's adultery rather than the ego defending its need to be right against someone else's opinion that it might not be. And that basic problem is so buried that after a while, nobody can even remember what it was. Teddy writes, then deal with the need for food rather than the idea that preceded it, in that you are a body and think you need food for that reason. Yes, I think that would be an example, that the fundamental error is I think I'm a body, and because I think I'm a body, then I think I need food, and then I get preoccupied with chasing food and forget about that the reason I've got a problem there is that I thought I was a body. if you think this world is real, you're a schmuck. Welcome to your schmuckdom. Okay. Thank you for the injection of humor. Change is impossible. I can create myself. Change is possible. It would be a primary illusion. I can create myself. Everything else follows is delusion. Uncorrected error of any kind deceives you of possibility for correction that is within you. Generally, yes, Jack. Where we are not yet purified and believe an error is true, that error tends to serve to blind is within us, because that error is likely to be the belief that the correction or the solution or the salvation lies outside us. You know, as Jesus says in the New Testament, don't go seeking the kingdom of heaven here or the kingdom of heaven there, as many people around him were doing. Where is it? Where is it? Where can I find the kingdom of heaven? They were asking him, where do I go to find the kingdom of heaven? And he says, it's as close to you as your right hand. And then later intensifies that with the kingdom of heaven is within you. And we are now running up to 2 minutes, so I'm going to thank everybody for showing up here, and thank you all for your contributions. It is really wonderful, delightful to share this material with you. And Deborah, here is the mic for your goodbyes.
Yeah, thank you very much, everybody. I really, really appreciate these sessions and your attendance. And thank you for all radio listeners. You're so important, too. Next week, same time, 4 to 6 p.m., this will continue, starting at T2B, the reinterpretation of defenses, I think. So thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Christian, did you want to throw something in there?
Thank you, Doug. It was something to do with an undoing that I don't understand, but I was guided to put up my hand. I'm a poet and I didn't know it. I'm also a psychic, according to Dove Fishman, and that really is news to me. Anyway, where were we? I was guided to put up my hand and say this. 9:30. I was guided to put up my hand, 6 p.m., Carmen Cameron, that's now. Right, Carmen, I know you're here because I saw your questions, so I'm going to be very quick. And I thank you. And I love your class, by the way, Carmen Cameron. I have the webcam on because I can have unlimited cam. So thank you for the cam, Ms. Cameron, Carmen Cameron, cam on cam. Get on with it, Christian. What was it? Okay, so I ring my friend David Woodrow in Cornwall, and he's 70-something. And last night, it was my birthday. And he disagreed with me on everything, and he, what we would call, these are just descriptive terms, they are not judgments. But I have to describe something to you in words. So he was disagreeing with everything I said, putting me down, running rings around me. He's a sort of intellectual, clever man. He was a teacher and he has, well, I'm really trying to say he has an incredible way with the Holy Spirit and his words to freeze me into a holy instant. If, like everybody, I listen. That means that I do not know that anything objectionable is going on. I do not have to override his opinion. He can disagree with me and appear to put me down and appear to do this because all of that is coming from delusion. All negative thought activity is completely unreal. Have you ever thought of that, folks? Sorry, I don't know where this is coming from, so I didn't actually take the mic to say this. Have you ever thought that negative thought activity in the slightest, what's that phrase, no matter how slight the touch of evil upon it, is completely untrue because you're listening to the Son of God. The Son of God, you've already got contact with him. Thank you, Jack Ruddy. You've got contact with him through the body. Your problem is using the ears of your holiness and not the ears of your darkness, which is not evil, but simply nothing at all. Is that simple enough for Jack Ruddy in Pennsylvania, I ask myself. Who was penning all these beautiful love notes in Pennsylvania. Or sort of through the sky, through heaven, through the transmission called Pennsylvania to me, saying, make things simple. Anyway, that's it. Carmen, are you ready? Trust me, I went into a total miracle when I just shut my mind up listening to my friend. He was argumentative as hell, so I just switched off and a complete miracle came over me. Thank you, David Woodrow.